Ruby! Ruby!
Liam was trying to get my attention because he hadn't seen what was up ahead. Zoo and Chubbs were sitting on the ground, outside of Betty. Their hands were handcuffed behind their backs, and their feet tied straight out in front of them with a length of bright yellow rope. Standing over them was none other than Lady Jane. This was the first time I had seen her up close. Close enough, at least, that I could make out the beauty mark on her cheek and the sunken quality to her eyes behind the black frames of her glasses. Her dark hair was down around her shoulders and curling with the humidity, but her skin still looked as though it had been pulled taut over the sharp angles of her face. Her black shirt was tucked neatly into her jeans, and a black utility belt was there to keep them both in place. I recognized the countless devices hanging from the belt. The orange identifier, a taser, handcuffs.
"Hello, Liam Stewart," the woman said, her accent cold and silky.
Next to me, Liam braced his feet and threw his arms up, to knock her back, I think. The woman only tisked, nodding ahead toward her outstretched left arm. My eyes followed its angle downward, to the gun pointed at Zoo's head.
"Lee!"
Chubb's voice was unnaturally high, but it was the look in Zoo's eyes that planted me in place.
"Come here," the woman said, "slowly, with your hands on top of your head. Now, Liam. Otherwise, I can't be sure that my finger won't slip."
She cocked her head to the side. Panic, I thought. The panic button, where? My backpack was somewhere tucked under the front passenger seat. If I could get to it, if I could reach the door.
"Yeah?"
Liam spat.
"And what's the going rate for me these days? How much did it get cut back when it took you 3 weeks to finally catch up to us?"
Her smile faltered, but returned with far more teeth than before.
"You're still at a healthy $250,000, love. You should feel proud of that. You barely fetched me $10,000 the first time around."
Liam was vibrating with rage, too choked up to speak. I heard his breath catch in his throat. I suddenly understood how he had known so much about her. This was the same woman who had captured him before.
"You can't imagine my surprise when your name popped back up in the bounty database, and with that kind of reward. It seems that you've gotten yourself in a fair bit of trouble since we last met."
"Yeah, well," Liam said, his voice rough, "I do my best."
"But, darling, how could you be stupid enough to go back to that place? Didn't you think I'd look for you there?"
The woman tilted her head again.
"Your friends were only too willing to tell me where you were headed and why, in exchange for letting them go. Lake Prince, is it?"
My pain gave way again to fear. If she finds East River. God, I couldn't even imagine the consequences. Liam could, from the look of it. His knuckles were white with the effort it took to keep his fingers clutched in his hair.
"If I can pull in that much for you, imagine what I'll get for a whole camp full of kids," she said. "Enough to finally buy my way home, I think, so thank you for that. You have no idea what kinds of funds it takes to get an official to look the other way and admit someone from a disease-ridden country."
The next second of silence that passed was deafening, only because I knew exactly what he would say next.
"If you let them all go, you can have me," he said, both hands still on his head. "I won't give you any trouble."
"No!" Chubb shouted. "Don't!"
The woman didn't even need a moment to consider it.
"You think I'm going to do you any favors? No, Liam Stewart, I'm going to take all of you, even that girl of yours. Maybe you should consider her condition before you try to bargain."
His eyes slid my way, taking in the blood streaking down my face. I tried to keep my vision straight as I took the tiniest step forward.
"I don't know where you came from, little girl, but I can assure you that where you're going won't be nearly as pleasant."
"I'm not going back." None of us were, not if I could help it.
"Come here," she said, her eyes on me, but her gun still trained on Liam. "You first, little girl. I'll take special care of you."
I went one step at a time, ignoring Liam's sharp intake of breath and the buzzing in my ears. My eyes went from Chubbs to Zoo to the woman's all-too-pleased face. Everyone was watching me. Everyone will know. And no one would be willing to have me after that.
"Turn around," the woman barked.
Her eyes flickered over to where her partner was still hidden behind a tangle of picnic tables. I saw her grip relax ever so slightly on her handgun, with her focus torn, and I took my chance. My knee flew up, nailing her just under her chest. The gun clattered to the ground, and I heard Liam take two running steps in my direction, but somehow I was faster. Blood was alive and warm on my face, dripping from my chin. The woman's eyes widened as my hand closed over her exposed throat, slamming her back against Betty's door. When her gaze met mine, I knew I had her. The pain that exploded behind my eyes told me so. Slipping into her head was as easy as releasing a sigh. Seeing her pupils shrink and explode back out to their normal size, it felt as though someone had wrapped a line of barbed wire around my brain and was tightening it with every passing second. Chubbs' face appeared at the corner of my vision, eyes wide. When he tried to stand, I knocked him back down with my foot. No, it wasn't safe. Not yet. The woman looked around, her eyes wide and unfocused. That's when the pounding began in my ears.
Da-da, 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 da-da.
I couldn't tell if it was my heart or hers. "Hand him your gun," I said, tilting my head toward the place I knew Liam was standing. When she didn't move, I pushed the image of her doing it through the bubbling black shapes of her mind. I couldn't bring myself to look at his reaction as the black weapon was placed in his outstretched hand. "Listen to me very carefully," I said. The blood was bitter in my mouth. "You are going to turn and walk back across the highway. You are going to walk into that forest and keep walking until an hour passes, and you are going to sit down in the middle of it and not move. You're not going to eat, or sleep, or drink, no matter how much you want to. You're not going to move." Imagining that into her mind, pushing the thought of her doing exactly that, was becoming more difficult. Not because my grip on her was slipping, but because my grip on consciousness was. "You can do this," I told myself. It didn't matter that no one had ever taught me, or that I had never practiced. In the end, it was all instinct, like I had known all along. I closed my eyes and went to work sorting through the darkened memories bubbling up behind her eyes. I found myself driving down the highway, one hand on the wheel, the other pointing to the rest stop up ahead. I parked the car a ways back, half hidden by the trees, and began to walk toward the lone black van in the parking lot. I stayed with this memory, taking in the scent of rain and grass, feeling the light breeze, until her partner reached the van, his rifle up and ready to fire. I forced the memory out of her mind, imagining nothing but air where Black Betty had been in the parking lot. I traced the line of memories back to the boys at Walmart, to the secret they had revealed about East River. The images slipped away in smears of light, like raindrops racing down a car window. "Now, you won't remember any of this, or any of us." "I won't remember any of this," she parroted, as though the thought had just occurred to her. I let go of her neck, but my pain didn't go away. Her eyes regained some of their focus. The pain didn't go away. She turned sharply on her heel and started to make her way toward the deserted highway. The pain didn't go away. No, it got worse. A trickle of sweat began at my temple and worked its way down the length of my spine. I was drenched. My hair clung to my face. My shirt was a second skin. I dropped into a crouch. If I was going to faint, it was better to stay close to the ground. God, I don't want to faint. Don't faint. Do not faint. I heard Liam say something. His foot came into my line of sight, and I leaned away. "Don't," I began. "Don't touch me. Not right now." And it was strange because the last thing I saw before I closed my eyes wasn't the old asphalt. It wasn't the sky or even my reflection in Betty's panels. It was a glimmering memory of my own, of a few days before when Liam had been in the driver's seat, singing along to Derek and the Dominoes' Layla at the top of his lungs, so off-key that it even had Chubbs laughing. Zoo had been sitting right behind him, moving in time with the music, her entire body rocking out to the wailing electric guitar. And it had been so easy then, to laugh and pretend, even if just for a second, that we would be okay, that I belonged with them. Because they hadn't known. None of them had known. And now that they did, it was over. It was all over now, and I would never have that back. I wished that I had gone for the panic button. I wished that Kate could come and take me away from them, back to the only people who would ever embrace me for the monster I was. 19. When I was about to turn 10 years old, the most significant thing about that number wasn't that it was double digits. It didn't really feel much like a birthday anyway. At dinner, I sat bookended by my parents at the table, moving peas around my plate, trying to ignore the fact that neither of them were speaking, to each other or to me. Mom's eyes were rimmed with red and glassy because of the argument they'd had a half hour before. She was still valiantly trying to gather up kids for a surprise birthday party for me, but Dad forced her to call and cancel, said it wasn't the kind of year to be celebrating, and, as the last kid alive on my block, it would be cruel of us to hang the birthday banner and tie up the usual cluster of balloons outside. I heard the whole thing from the top of the stairs. I didn't really care about the birthday either way. It wasn't like I had anyone left I really wanted to invite. What was more important to me was the fact that, at 10, I was suddenly old, or rather would be old soon. I'd start to look like the girls in the magazines, be forced to wear dresses and high heels and makeup. Go to high school. In 10 years from tomorrow, I'll be 20. I don't know why I said it out loud. It was just this profound realization, and it had to be shared. The silence that followed was actually painful. Mom sat straight up and pressed her napkin to her mouth. For a moment, I thought she might stand up and leave, but Dad's hand came down to rest on top of hers, settling her like an anchor. Dad finished chewing on his barbecued chicken before giving me a smile that quivered at the edges. He leaned down a ways, so our identical green eyes met. "That's right, little bee. And how old will you be 10 years after that?"
30, I said. "And you'll be 52.
He chuckled. "That's right, halfway to the grave," my mind whispered. "Halfway to the grave." Dad realized his mistake before the word fully left his mouth, but it didn't matter. All three of us knew what he meant. Grave. I knew what death was. I knew what happened after you died. At school, they brought in special visitors to talk to the kids that came back. The one assigned to our room, Miss Finch, gave her presentation 2 weeks before Christmas, wearing a bright pink turtleneck and glasses that covered half of her face. She wrote everything out on the whiteboard in thick, capital letters. Death is not sleeping. It happens to everyone. It could happen at any time. You do not come back. When people die, she explained, they stop breathing. They do not have to eat, they no longer speak, and they cannot think or miss us like we miss them. They do not ever, ever wake up. She kept giving us more examples, like we were too stupid or little to understand, like the six of us left hadn't sat there and watched Grace's lights go out. Dead cats cannot purr, and dead dogs cannot play. Dead flowers, Miss Finch pointed to the bundle of dried flowers on my teacher's desk, do not grow or bloom anymore. Hours of this. Hours of being asked, "Do you understand?" But for all of her answers, she never got around to the one question I had wanted to ask. What does it feel like? Dad looked up sharply.
What does what feel like?
I looked down at my plate. To die, do you feel it? I know that it's not the same for everyone, and that you stop breathing and your heart stops beating. But what does that feel like?
Ruby!
I could hear the horror in Mom's voice. It's okay if it hurts, I said. But are you still in your body after things stop working? Do you know that you've died?
Ruby!
Dad's bushy eyebrows drew together as his shoulder slumped.
Well, don't you dare,
Mom said, using her free hand to try to pry his big one off her other trembling fingers.
Jacob, don't you dare!
I kept my hands clenched together under the table, trying not to stare at Mom's face as it paled from a deep red to a stark white.
No one, Dad began. No one knows, sweetheart. I can't give you an answer. Everyone finds out when it's their time. I guess it probably depends.
Stop it,
Mom said, slapping her other hand down on the table. Our plates jumped in time with her palm.
Ruby, go to your room.
Calm down, Dad told her in a stern voice. This is important to talk about.
It is not. It absolutely is not. How dare you? First you cancel the party, and when I told you...
She strained against his grip. I watched, my lips parting as she picked up her water glass and threw it at his head. In ducking, he lifted his hand from the table, just enough for her to wrench away and stand. Her chair clattered to the ground a second after the glass shattered against the wall behind Dad's head. I screamed. I didn't mean to, but it slipped out. Mom came around to my side of the table and grabbed me by the elbow, hauling me up, nearly taking the tablecloth with me.
Cut it out, I heard Dad say.
Stop. We have to talk to her about it. The doctor said we needed to prepare her.
You're hurting me, I managed to choke out. Mom startled at the sound of my voice, looking down at where her nails were digging into the soft skin of my upper arm.
Oh, my God.
She said, but I was already in the hallway, flying up the stairs, slamming my bedroom door shut and locking it behind me, closing out the sound of my parents screaming at each other. I dove under my heavy purple bed covers, knocking the row of carefully arranged stuffed animals to the ground. I didn't bother to change out of the clothes I had worn to school or turn off the lights, not until I was sure my parents were still in the kitchen and far away from me. An hour later, breathing the same hot air under the comforter in and out, listening to the rattle of the air vent, I thought about the other significant thing about turning 10. Grace had been 10. So had Frankie and Peter and Mario and Ramona. So had half of my class, the half that never came back after Christmas. 10 is the most common age for IAAN to manifest, I had overheard a newscaster saying, but the affliction can claim anyone between the ages of 8 and 14. I straightened my legs out and pressed my arms in at my sides. I held my breath and shut my eyes, staying as still as possible. Dead. Miss Finch had described it like a series of stops and knots. Stopped breathing, not moving, stopped heart, not sleeping. It didn't seem like it should have been that simple.
When a loved one dies, they don't get to wake up, she had said. There are no comebacks or do-overs. You may wish they could come back, but it's important that you understand they can't, and they won't.
Tears slipped down the side of my face, dripping into my ears and hair. I turned to the side, smashing a pillow over my face, trying to block out the screaming match downstairs. Were they coming up to my room to yell at me? Once or twice I heard heavy footsteps on the stairs, but then Dad's voice would float up to me, booming and terrible, yelling words I didn't like or understand. Mom sounded like she was being gutted. I drew my legs up to my chest and pressed my face against my knees. For every two breaths I was taking in, I was lucky to get one out. Inside my chest, my heart had been racing for what felt like hours, jumping with every shatter or thud from downstairs. I stuck my head over the covers just once to make sure that I had locked the door. That would make them even angrier if they tried it, but I didn't care. My head felt light and heavy all at once, but worst of all was the pounding. the dum, dum, dum at the back of my head, like something was inside of me knocking against my skull, trying to break out. "Stop it," I whispered, squeezing my eyes shut against the pain. My hands were shaking so hard I couldn't keep them over my ears. "Please, please stop." Hours later, when my feet carried me downstairs, I found them in their dark bedroom, deep into sleep. I stood in the sliver of light coming through their open doorway, waiting to see if they would wake up. I had half a mind to climb into bed between them like I used to do, into that small space between them that I knew was warm and safe. But Dad had told me I was too big to be doing such silly things. So, instead, I walked over to my mom's side of the bed and kissed her goodnight. Her cheek was slick with rosemary-scented cream, cool and smooth to the touch. The instant I pressed my lips there, I jumped back, a flash of white burning inside my eyelids. For one strange second, the image of my own face had leaped to the front of a long series of jumbled thoughts, then disappeared, like a photo drifting into dark water. Her blanket must have shocked me. The jolt traveled all the way up to my brain, flashing it white for a second. She must not have felt it because she didn't wake up. Neither did Dad, even when the same strange thing happened. As I made my way back upstairs, the tightness in my chest vanished, lifting away with the comforter as I kicked it to the floor. The head-splitting pain released its grip on my brain, leaving me feeling like my tank had run empty. I had to close my eyes to block out the sight of my room swaying in the darkness. And then it was morning. My alarm went off at 7 exactly, switching over to the radio, just as Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was starting. I remember sitting straight up in bed, more surprised than anything. I touched my face, my chest. The room seemed unnaturally bright for so early in the morning, despite the curtains being closed, and within only a few minutes the headache had crept back in, claws out. I rolled out of bed and onto the floor, my stomach turning with me. I waited until the dark spots had stopped floating in my eyes and tried to swallow to ease my dry throat. I knew this feeling. I knew what the clenching in my guts meant. Sick. I was sick on my birthday. I stumbled out of bed, changing into my Batman PJs on the way to the door. Mom would be even angrier at me if she knew I had slept in my nice button-down shirt. It was wrinkled and drenched in sweat, despite the cold clinging to my bedroom window. Maybe she'd feel bad about the night before and let me stay home to show how sorry she was. I wasn't even halfway down the stairs when I saw the wreckage in the living room. From the landing, it looked like a pack of animals had gotten in and had a field day throwing around pillows, overturning an armchair, and smashing every single glass candle holder that had been on the now cracked coffee table. Every picture on the fireplace mantle was face down on the ground, as were the line of school portraits my mom had placed on the table behind the couch. And then there were the books. Dozens of them. Mom must have emptied out every book in the library in her anger. They littered the ground like rainbow candy. But as scary as that room was, I didn't feel like throwing up until I reached the last step and smelled bacon, not pancakes. We didn't have many traditions as a family, but chocolate pancakes on birthdays was one of them, and the one we were least likely to forget. For the past 3 years, they'd forgotten to leave out milk and cookies for Santa, somehow forgotten their pact that we would go camping every 4th of July weekend, and even, on occasion, forgot to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. But forgetting the birthday pancakes? Or maybe she was just mad enough at me not to make them. Maybe she hated me after what I had said last night. Mom had her back to me when I walked into the kitchen and shielded my eyes from the sunlight streaming through the window above the sink. Her dark hair was pulled back into a low, messy bun, resting against the collar of her red robe. I had a matching one. Dad had bought them for Christmas the month before. "Ruby red for my Ruby," he had said. She was humming under her breath, one hand flipping the bacon on the stove, the other holding a folded newspaper. Whatever song was stuck in her head was upbeat, chipper, and, for a moment, I really did think the stars had aligned for me. She was over last night, She was going to let me stay home. After months of being angry and upset over the tiniest things, she was finally happy again. Mom? Then again, louder. Mom! She turned around so quickly she knocked the pan off the stove and nearly dropped the gray paper into the open flame there. I saw her reach back and slap her hand against the knobs, twisting a dial until the smell of gas disappeared.
I don't feel good. Can I stay home today?
No response. Not even a blink. Her jaw was working, grinding, but it took me walking over to the table and sitting down for her to find her voice.
How did you get in here?
I have a bad headache and my stomach hurts, I told her, putting my elbows up on the table. I knew she hated when I whined, but I didn't think she hated it enough to come over and grab me by the arm again.
I asked you how you got in here, young lady. What's your name?
Her voice sounded strange.
Where do you live?
Her grip on my skin only tightened the longer I waited to answer. It had to have been a joke, right? Was she sick, too? Sometimes cold medicine did funny things to her. Funny things, though, not scary things.
Can you tell me your name? She repeated.
Ouch! I yelped, trying to pull my arm away.
Mom, what's wrong?
She yanked me up from the table, forcing me onto my feet.
Where are your parents? How did you get in this house?
Something tightened in my chest to the point of snapping.
Mom! Mommy, why?
Stop it, she hissed.
Stop calling me that. What are you?
I think I must have tried to say something else, but she dragged me over to the door that led out into the garage. My feet slid against the wood, skin burning.
What's wrong with you?
I cried. I tried twisting out of her grasp, but she wouldn't even look at me. Not until we were at the door to the garage and she pushed my back up against it.
We can do this the easy way or the hard way. I know you're confused, but I promise that I'm not your mother. I don't know how you got into this house, and frankly, I'm not sure I want to know.
I live here, I told her.
I live here. I'm Ruby.
When she looked at me again, I saw none of the things that made Mom my mother. The lines that formed around her eyes when she smiled were smoothed out, and her jaw was clenched around whatever she wanted to say next. When she looked at me, she didn't see me. I wasn't invisible, but I wasn't Ruby.
Mom! I started to cry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be bad. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Please, I promise I'll be good. I'll go to school today and won't be sick, and I'll pick up my room. I'm sorry. Please remember. Please.
She put one hand on my shoulder and the other on the door handle.
My husband is a police officer. He'll be able to help you get home. Wait in here and don't touch anything.
The door opened and I was pushed into a wall of freezing January air. I stumbled down onto the dirty, oil-stained concrete, just managing to catch myself before I slammed into the side of her car. I heard the door shut behind me and the lock click into place. Heard her call Dad's name as clearly as I heard the birds in the bushes outside the dark garage. She hadn't even turned on the light for me. I pushed myself up onto my hands and knees, ignoring the bite of the frosty air on my bare skin. I launched myself in the direction of the door, fumbling around until I found it. I tried shaking the handle, jiggling it, still thinking, hoping, praying that this was some big birthday surprise, and that by the time I got back inside, there would be a plate of pancakes at the table, and Dad would bring in the presents, and we could pretend like the night before had never happened, even with the evidence in the next room over. The door was locked.
I'm sorry,
I was screaming, pounding my fists against it.
Mommy, I'm sorry, please.
Dad appeared a moment later, his stocky shape outlined by the light from inside of the house. I saw Mom's bright red face over his shoulder. He turned to wave her off and then reached over to flip on the overhead lights.
Dad,
I said, throwing my arms around his waist. He let me keep them there, but all I got in return was a light pat on the back. You're safe, he told me in his usual soft, rumbling voice. Dad, there's something wrong with her, I was babbling. The tears were burning on my cheeks. I didn't mean to be bad. You have to fix her, okay? She's...
I know. I believe you.
At that, he carefully peeled my arms off his uniform and guided me down so we were sitting on the step, facing Mom's maroon sedan. He was fumbling in his pockets for something, listening to me as I told him everything that had happened since I walked into the kitchen. He pulled out a small pad of paper from his pocket.
Daddy,
I tried again, but he cut me off, putting down an arm between us. I understood. No touching. I had seen him do something like this before, on Take Your Child to Work Day at the station. The way he spoke, the way he wouldn't let me touch him. I had watched him treat another kid this way, only that one had a black eye and a broken nose. That kid had been a stranger. Any hope I had felt bubbling up inside me burst into a thousand tiny pieces.
Did your parents tell you that you'd been bad? He asked when he could get a word in. Did you leave your house because you were afraid they would hurt you?
I pushed myself up off the ground. This is my house, I wanted to scream. You are my parents. My throat felt like it had closed up on itself.
You can talk to me, he said very gently. I won't let anyone hurt you. I just need your name, and then we can go down to the station and make some calls.
I don't know what part of what he was saying finally broke me, but before I could stop myself, I had launched my fists against him, hitting him over and over, like that would drive some sense back into him.
I am your kid, I screamed. I'm Ruby.
You've got to calm down, Ruby, he told me, catching my wrists. It'll be okay. I'll call ahead to the station, and then we'll go.
No!
I shrieked.
No!
He pulled me off him again and stood making his way to the door. My nails caught the back of his hand, and I heard him grunt in pain. He didn't turn back around as he shut the door. I stood alone in the garage, less than 10 feet away from my blue bike, from the tent that we had used to camp in dozens of times, from the sled I'd almost broken my arm on. All around the garage and house were pieces of me. But Mom and Dad, they couldn't put them together. They didn't see the completed puzzle standing in front of them. But eventually they must have seen the pictures of me in the living room, or gone up to my mess of the room.
That's not my child,
I could hear my mom yelling through the walls. She was talking to Grams. She had to be. Grams would set her straight.
I have no child. She's not mine. I already called them. Don't. Stop it. I'm not crazy.
I had to hide. I couldn't let him take me to the police station, but I also couldn't dial 911 to get them help. Maybe if I waited it out, they'd get better on their own? I dashed toward the storage tubs on the other side of the garage, squeezing past the front of Mom's car. One, maybe two steps more, and I would have jumped inside the closest tub and buried myself under a pile of blankets. The garage door rolled open first. Not all the way. Just enough that I could see the snow on the driveway and grass and the bottom half of a dark uniform. I squinted, holding a hand up to the blinding blanket of white light that seemed to settle over my vision. My head started pounding, 1,000 times worse than before. The man in the dark uniform knelt down in the snow, his eyes hidden by sunglasses. I hadn't seen him before, but I certainly hadn't met all the police officers at my dad's station. This one looked older. Harder, I remembered thinking. He waved me forward again, saying,
We're here to help you. Please come outside.
I took a tentative step, then another. This man is a police officer, I told myself. Mom and Dad are sick, and they need help. His navy uniform looked darker the closer I got, like it was drenched straight through with rain. My parents... The officer didn't let me finish.
Come out here, honey. You're safe now.
It wasn't until my bare toes brushed up against the snow and the man had wrapped my long hair around his fist and yanked me through the opening that I even realized his uniform was black. When I finally came to in the gray light, I knew by the curve of the rear seat and the smell of fake lemon detergent that I was back in Betty. The van wasn't on and running, and the road wasn't passing underneath me, but the keys had been left in the ignition and the radio was on. Bob Dylan whispered the opening verse of Forever Young through the speakers. The song cut off abruptly, replaced by the DJ's flustered voice.
"Sorry about that."
The man let out a nervous, breathy laugh.
"I don't know why the system brought that one up. It's on the no playlist. Back to the music. This one's a request from Bill out in Suffolk. Here's We Gotta Get Out of This Place by The Animals."
I opened one eye and tried to sit up with zero success. The throbbing in my head was so brutal I had to clench my teeth to keep from getting sick all over myself. A good 5 minutes must have passed before I felt strong enough to reach up and touch the pain's epicenter on my right temple. My fingers brushed against the jagged, raised surface of my skin, feeling each coarse stitch holding it together. Chubbs. I pulled my right arm in front of me. It flopped around, useless and asleep, until the blood began to fill it again. Then it was fire and needles. But the pain was good. It roused the rest of me from its stubborn sleep. It didn't let me forget. I should go, I thought. Now, before they get back. The thought of seeing any of their faces made my chest feel like it was going to explode. They know. They know. I did start to cry then. I wasn't proud of it, but I knew I couldn't go through this again and come out of it in one piece. Footsteps sounded outside.
Saying it's too dangerous.
Chubbs.
We need to consider getting rid of her.
I don't want to talk about this right now.
Liam sounded agitated. I used one of the seat belts to pull me upright. The sliding door was wide open, giving me a perfect view of where Chubbs and Liam stood in front of a small fire, which was ringed by a series of mismatched stones. The sky was dipping into night.
When are we going to talk about it then?
Chubbs said.
Never? We're just going to pretend like it never happened?
Zoo will be back soon.
Good,
Chubbs shouted. Good. This is her decision too.
This is all of our decision, not just yours.
Liam's face was as red as I had ever seen it.
What the hell are we supposed to do, just dump her here?
Yes, I thought. That's exactly what you should do. And I had started to climb over the middle seats to tell them that much when Chubbs lurched forward, throwing Liam onto his back without touching him. Unfazed, Liam pressed his mouth into a tight line, raised his hand, and literally pulled the ground out from under his friend's feet. Chubbs hit the dirt with a sharp gasp, too stunned to do anything but lie there. Liam stayed on the ground, too, pressing his fists against his eyes.
"Why are you doing this to us?"
Chubbs cried.
"Do you want to get caught?"
I know,"
Liam said. "This is my fault. I should have been more careful." "Why didn't you just tell me?"
Chubbs continued.
"Did you know this whole time? Why lie about it? Do you even want to get home, or—"
"Charles!" His name cracked as it left my throat. I didn't think I sounded anything like myself, but the boys recognized my voice at once. Chubbs' face lost some of its heat as he turned to where I stood clutching the minivan's sun-warmed frame. Liam pushed himself up off the ground.
"I'm gonna go. So you don't fight anymore, okay?"
I said.
"I'm sorry I lied to you. I know I should have left, but I wanted to help you get home because you had helped me. And I'm sorry. I'm so... so sorry."
"Ruby,"
Chubbs said, then again louder.
"Ruby." "Oh, for the love of—" "We were talking about Black Betty, not your orange ass."
I froze. I thought, I understand why you would leave me behind.
"Huh?"
Liam looked horrified.
"We left the radio on in case you woke up, so you'd know that we didn't leave you."
God help me, that only made me cry harder. When a girl cries, few things are more worthless than a boy. Having two of them just meant that they stared at each other helplessly instead of at me. Chubbs and Liam stood, up to their ears and awkward, until Chubbs finally reached out and patted my head like he would have patted a dog. "You thought we wanted to get rid of you because you're not really green?"
Liam sounded like he was having a hard time wrapping his head around that.
I mean, I'm not thrilled you didn't trust us enough to tell us the truth, but that was your secret.
I trust you, I do, I said, but I didn't want you to think that I had forced my way in or manipulated you. I didn't want you to be afraid of me.
Okay, first, Liam said, why would we think that you pulled a Jedi mind trick on us to let you stay? We voted. We asked you.
Second, what in the name of God's green earth is wrong with being orange? You have no idea what I'm capable of.
Exactly, Chubbs cut in. We have no idea,
but it's not like we're going to win any awards for normalcy anytime soon. So you get into people's heads. The two of us can throw people around like toys. Zoo once blew up an AC unit, and all she did was walk by it. It wasn't the same, and they didn't understand that.
I can't always control it like you can, I said. And sometimes I do things. Bad things. I see things I shouldn't. I turn people into things they aren't. It's horrible. When I'm in someone's head, it's like quicksand. The more I try to pull free, the more damage I do.
Chubb started to say something, only to stop. Liam leaned down so his face was level with mine, so close that our foreheads were nearly touching. We want you, he said, his hand slipping through my hair to cup the back of my neck. We wanted you yesterday, we want you today, and we'll want you tomorrow. There's nothing you could do to change that. If you're scared and you don't understand your crazy abilities, then we'll help you understand. But don't think, not for one second, that we would ever just leave you.
He waited until I was looking him in the eye before continuing. Is this why you acted that way when I said the slip kid might be an orange? Is that really why you want to find him? Or do you just want to go to your grandmother's? Because either way, darling, we'll get you there.
Both, I said. Was it so wrong to want both? I had stopped crying, but my lungs felt sticky, heavy, and getting in even an ounce of air was too much effort. I don't know why my brain was as still as it was, but I was trying not to think about it. Liam and Chubbs both took an arm. I was lifted out of the van, guided over to the crackling fire.
Where are we? I asked finally.
Somewhere between North Carolina and the Great Dismal Swamp, I hope, Liam said, his hand still on my back, now rubbing circles there. Southeast Virginia. Now that you're awake, I need to check on Zoo. You two stay put, okay?
Chubbs nodded. We watched Liam go in silence. Then Chubbs turned to me.
Ruby, he began, voice perfectly serious. Can you tell me who the president is?
I blinked. Can you tell me why you're asking this question?
Do you remember what happened?
Did I? The memory was milky and distorted, like I was glimpsing someone else's dream.
Angry man, I said. Rifle. Ruby's head. Ouch.
Cut it out, I'm being serious.
I winced, touching the stitching in my forehead again.
Can you keep your voice down? It feels like my head is about to cave in.
Yeah, well, serves you right for scaring the hell out of all of us. Here, keep drinking this, he said, handing me what was left of our water bottle. It didn't matter that the water was stale or warm. I finished it off in one gulp. I mean, my dad used to say that head wounds look worse than they actually are, but I legitimately thought you were a corpse.
Thanks for stitching me up, I said. I'm looking a little Frankenstein, but I guess it's appropriate, all things considered.
Chubbs gave me a weary sigh. Frankenstein is the name of the doctor that created the monster, not the monster itself.
Couldn't let that one go, could you?
Don't get on my case about it. You're the one that doesn't know her classic literature.
Funny, I don't think they had that one in Thurman's library. I hadn't meant for it to come out as sharply as it did, but it wasn't a pleasant experience being reminded that your education level equaled that of a 10-year-old. He had the decency to look apologetic as he let out a deep sigh. It's just... take it easy, will you? My heart can only take so much stress. All along, while listening to Chubbs and Liam try to talk me down, some part of me had been trying to work through the argument I had overheard. I could understand, as horrifying as it was, the need to leave Betty behind. The PSFs and skip tracers all seemed to know to look for her now. But there had been something else underlying their words, something else that had them at odds. I had a feeling I knew exactly what it was, but I couldn't ask Liam. I wanted the truth, not a sugar-coated version of it. The team reality take. Only Chubbs could give that to me. But I hesitated, because next to his feet on the ground between us was Chubbs' copy of Watership Down, and I kept thinking about this one line, the one that had made me so angry the first time I read it as a little kid. Rabbits need dignity, and, above all, the will to accept their fate. In the book, the rabbits had come across this warren, this community, that accepted food handouts from humans in exchange for accepting that some of them would be killed by the same humans in return. Those rabbits stopped fighting the system, because it was easier to take the loss of freedom, to forget what it was like before the fence kept them in, than to be out there in the world struggling to find shelter and food. They had decided that the loss of some was worth the temporary comfort of many. "Will it always be this way?" I asked, drawing my knees up to my chest and pressing my face against them. "Even if we find East River and we get help, there's always going to be a Lady Jane around the corner, isn't there? Will it even be worth it?" The will to accept their fate. In our case, that fate was to never see our families again, to always be hunted and chased down to every dark pocket of earth we tried to hide inside. Something had to give. We couldn't live that way. We weren't made to. I felt him drop a heavy palm on the back of my head, but it was a long time before he could piece together his thoughts. "Maybe nothing will ever change for us," he said. "But don't you want to be around, just in case it does?" I don't know if it was the smoke from the campfire that calmed me, or the sudden reappearance of Zoo, who had come back from scouting a nearby campsite, making sure it was deserted. As she wrapped her arms around my waist, the boys began to pool together what was left of the food and Betty. "So that's how you figured out the clue," Liam said. "You saw a memory of it?" I nodded. "Not so impressive now, is it?" "No, no, that's not what I meant," Liam said, adding quickly, "It's just I'm trying to imagine what the inside of that kid's head looked like, and the best I can come up with is a swamp filled with alligators. It must have been terrible." "Not as terrible as slipping into someone's head I actually like," I admitted. "Did you?" Chubb said after nearly 10 minutes of silence. Liam was busy testing out whether he could use Betty's car key to pry open the lids of the fruit and soup cans. "Did I what?"
"Did you ever get inside our heads?"
he finished. The way he asked reminded me of the way a kid would ask for the end of a bedtime story. Eager. Surprising. In all of my nightmares about them finding out the truth, I had pictured Chubbs taking it the worst.
"Of course she's in our heads," Liam said, his arm straining to open the can's lid. "Ruby is one of us now."
"That's not what I meant," Chubbs huffed.
"I just want to know how it works. I've never met an orange before. We didn't have any at Caledonia."
"That's probably because the government erased them all," I said, dropping my hands in my lap. "That's what happened to them at Thurmond." Liam looked up, alarmed.
"What do you mean?"
"For the first 2 or 3 years I was there, we had every kind of color, even red and orange," I said. "But no one really knows why or how it happened. Some people thought they were taken away because of all the trouble they caused, but there were rumors they were being moved to a new camp where they could do more testing on them. We just woke up one morning and the reds, oranges, and yellows were gone."
And it was just as terrifying for me to think about it now as it was then.
"What about you, though?" Chubbs asked. "How did you avoid getting bussed?"
"I pretended to be green from the start," I said.
I saw how scared the PS ops were of the oranges, and I messed with the scientist who was running the classifying test. It was a struggle to push the rest of the words out. Those kids were... they were so messed up, you know? Maybe they were like that before they got their abilities, or they hated themselves for having them, but they used to do terrible things.
Like what? Chubbs pressed.
Oh, God, I couldn't even talk about it. I physically could not speak. Not about the hundreds of mind games I watched them play on the PSFs. Nothing about the memory of having to scrub the floors of the mess hall after an orange told a PSF to walk in and open fire on every other soldier he saw there. My stomach turned violently, and I could taste it, the metallic bitterness of blood. Smell it. I remembered how it felt to scrape it out from where it was packed painfully under my nails. Chubbs opened his mouth, but Liam held up a hand to shut him up. I just knew I needed to protect myself. And truthfully, because I was scared of the oranges, too. There was something wrong with them. With us. It was the constant chatter, the flood of everyone else's feelings and thoughts, I think. Eventually, you learned how to block some of it out, to build up a thin wall between your mind and others, but not before everyone else's poisonous thoughts were in there, staining your own. Some spent so long outside of their own heads that they couldn't function right when they finally had to return to their own. So, now you see, I said finally, what a mistake it was to let me stay. Zoo was shaking her head, looking distraught at the suggestion. Chubbs rubbed at his eyes, hiding his expression. Only Liam was willing to look me straight in the eye, and there was no disgust or fear or any of the thousand other ugly emotions he was entitled to. Only understanding. "Try to imagine where we'd be without you, darling," he said quietly. "And then maybe you'll see just how lucky we got."
20. That night, we slept in the van, each sprawled out on a seat. I let Zoo have the rear seat and stayed up front next to Liam. I felt uneasy in the silence, and sleep didn't come easy, even when I called to it. Sometime around 5 in the morning, just as I was about to give in to the fuzz covering my brain, I felt someone run a light finger down the back of my neck. I rolled over onto my other side, and Liam was there, half awake.
"You were muttering to yourself," he whispered. "You okay?"
I propped myself up on an elbow, wiping the sleep away from my eyes. The rain had condensed on the windows, covering the cracked windshield like a filmy overlay of lace. Every time a fat raindrop dislodged itself and went streaking down the glass, it was like a tear in the fabric. Looking out into the forest was like searching someone's dreams, disorienting and unsettling. But inside the van, everything was sharp. The lines of the reclining seats, the dashboard knobs. I could even read the tiny printed brand name on the buttons of Liam's shirt. In that light, I could see every bruise and cut on his face, some just beginning to heal, and others that had long since scarred. But what held my attention wasn't the bruise on his cheek, the same one I had given him a few days and lifetimes before, but the way his hair was standing almost straight up, curling around his ears and against his neck. The storm had turned its color to a darker shade of honey, but it didn't lose any of its softness. It didn't make me want to reach out and touch it any less.
"What?" he whispered. "What are you smiling about?"
My fingers brushed against his hair, trying to smooth it down. I realized what I was doing a full minute after Liam had closed his eyes and leaned into my touch. Embarrassment flared up in my chest, but he grabbed my hand before I could pull back and tucked it under his chin.
"Nope," he whispered when I tried to tug it away. "Mine now."
"Dangerous. This is dangerous." The warning was fleeting, banished to the back corners of my mind, where it wouldn't interrupt how good it felt to touch him. How right. "I'm going to need it back eventually," I said, letting him run it along the stubble on his chin.
"Too bad." "Crackers,"
a voice breathed out behind us.
"Yes?"
Both of us turned, watching as Chubbs twisted around in his seat and settled back down, still fast asleep. I pressed a hand over my mouth to keep from laughing. Liam rolled his eyes, smiling.
He dreams about food, he said. A lot.
At least they're good dreams.
Yeah, Liam agreed. I guess he's lucky. I looked back at Chubb's curled-up form and, for the first time, realized just how cold it was without the heat from Betty's vent. Liam let his head slide down to rest against his other arm, threading his fingers through mine. He seemed to be studying the shape they made, the way my thumb appeared to rest naturally on top of his.
If you wanted to, he began, could you see what he was dreaming about?
I nodded. But those things are private.
But you've done it before.
Not intentionally.
To me?
To the girls in my cabin at camp, I said. To Zoo that night in the motel. I've been in your head. Once. Just not in your dreams.
2 days ago, he said, putting it together, at the rest stop.
It was instinct to pull back, to let go before I felt him let go first, but he didn't allow me.
Don't, he said. I'm not mad.
He brought our hands down against his forehead, not looking at me when he asked,
does it make it worse, to be touching someone, I mean? Is it harder to control?
Sometimes, I admitted. I didn't know how to explain it, because I had never wanted to. Sometimes, when I'm tired or upset, I'll pick up on someone's thoughts or a memory they're thinking about, but I can avoid being pulled in if I don't touch the person. Touching them when my head is like that, it's an automatic connection.
I thought so.
Liam sighed, closing his eyes again.
You know, when we first met, you used to go out of your way to avoid touching us. I kept wondering if it was something you had been trained to do at your camp, because every time one of us would try to touch you or talk to you, you'd jump like we had shocked you.
I didn't want to hurt any of you, I whispered. His eyes flashed open again, somehow brighter than before. He nodded to our linked fingers.
Is this okay?
Are you okay? I countered. I recognized the look on his face. It was nearly identical to the grief he'd worn at the rest stop, talking about his own camp.
What are you thinking about? I was thinking about how strange it is that we haven't even known each other for 2 weeks, but it feels like I've known you for much longer than that, he said. And I'm thinking that it's frustrating to feel like I know certain parts of you so well, but other parts of you, I don't even know what your life was like before you went to camp.
What could I tell him? What could I say about what I had done to my parents and to Sam that wouldn't scare him into letting go?
This is a place where we don't have to lie, he said, motioning between us. Didn't you tell me that?
You remember?
Of course I do, he said, because I keep hoping that goes both ways. That if I ask you why you don't want to go home to your parents, you'll tell me the truth. Or if I ask you what Thurman was really like, you'll stop lying. But then I realized that it's not fair, because it's not like I want to talk about my family. It's like those...
I turned to look at him, waiting as he tried to piece together his thought.
I don't know if I can explain it, he said. It's hard to put into words. Those things, those memories, are mine, you know? They're the things that the camp didn't take away when I went in, and they're the things I don't have to share if I don't want to.
I guess that's stupid.
It's not stupid, I said. That's not stupid at all. And I want to talk about everything with you. Everything. But I don't know what to tell you about Caledonia, he said. I don't know what I can tell you that won't make you hate me. I was stupid and I'm embarrassed and ashamed, and I know that Charles and Zoo blame me for what happened. And I know that Cole has told Mom about it by now, and she's told Harry, and the thought just makes me sick.
You did what you thought was right, I said. I'm sure they understand that. He shook his head, swallowing hard. I reached over with my other hand to brush the hair out of his eyes. The way he turned his face toward me again, closing his eyes and tilting his chin, made me brave enough to do it again. My fingers followed the natural wave of his hair, tracing the strands down around his ear.
What do you want to do?
I whispered.
I've got to wake the others up, he said. We have to keep moving. On foot.
My hand stilled, but it was clear that he had made his choice.
What's the rush?
I asked lightly. There, at the right corner of his mouth,